Hello and welcome to the Money Week podcast. I am Merin Somerset, web editor-in-chief of the magazine, and today I have with me not John Stepak, I know that will be disappointing to some of you, but a specialist, David Cornell, the manager of the India Capital Growth Fund. And we are going to talk a little bit about India, why India, what's going on in India, do you want to invest in India, and in particular, of course, from David's point of view, do you want to invest in his fund? We can all guess what his answer will be to that final question. But let's start, David, with what's going on politically in India at the moment. It is in the middle of the world's biggest election, what, 900 million voters, and we've got a couple of days of voting to go. We won't get the result until middle end of May. What is it, May 23rd?
May 23rd, yeah.
May 23rd. So this is, it's always very exciting anyway, an Indian election, because so many people, so many constituencies, so much going on. Who's going to win and what difference is it going to make?
Marion, well, it's going to be a tightly fought battle. 8 months ago or so, it was widely assumed that Mr. Modi and his BJP party and the alliance of regional parties that work with him would come back to power. Subsequent to that, and mainly because there's been a lot of problems in rural India, he's not such a shoo-in as he was expected to be. But nonetheless, I think he'll scramble home. The magic number that he needs to reach is 274 seats. Current consensus is that he'll get around 220, and then with his alliance partners, he'll get across that to 74 number, which is just over half the elected members of the lower house. What's interesting, I think, is that it's very important that he does get back, not least because of the benefits of the continuity that his reformist style of government will bring. And I think if he does come back, he'll come back as a more effective leader, a slightly shrewder leader with a better team. The step up from, he was chief minister of Gujarat for 9 years before he came prime minister. It's a big step up from running the state to running the country. And I think a second 5-year term in office will be very beneficial for the country.
And what kind of reforms would come next? I mean, there's been some fairly big stuff over the last couple of years. If he does get back in and he has the seats to do it, what would be his next big changes?
So if I had a wish list, I do have a wish list.
I bet you do have a wish list.
there are a number of things. I think, when you look at the factors of production, land, labour and capital, I think in the first term of office, he's done a huge amount to lower the cost of capital, which is a major benefit, a huge positive to economic growth and also to equity investors. That reform of capital is being brought about by formalisation of the banking system, encouraging an opening up of bank accounts for the lower end of the society, formalising the savings process, so bringing money from under the mattress, literally, and bringing money from assets like gold and real estate into financial products. It brings down the cost of capital. It makes the savings in the country more productive. That box has been ticked. I think that's an ongoing process. I don't think it'll be reversed. I think in terms of labour, we need to see unification of labour laws. It needs to be a country which...
What do you mean by unification of labour laws? Do you mean there are different labour laws in different regions at the moment?
Exactly. So if you think about Europe, 28 states in Europe all running at slightly different speeds. The unification of Europe is a complex process, as we know well. In India, it's not too dissimilar. 28 different states, different cultures, different languages, different laws, state by state, and it needs to be brought together under under sort of a simpler structure, so that particularly if you're a foreign company coming into India wanting to take advantage of some of the benefits of manufacturing there, you're going to find it a lot easier if the labour laws are a bit clearer. And they haven't really been refreshed, for 100 years. So it's not easy to hire and fire people in India. And that, as puts off, meaningful investment from corporates. So unification of labour laws, I think alongside that, land aggregation is a massive opportunity to improve productivity. By that I mean, you know, taking small farm holdings and putting them together to make more productive agricultural output.
You know, this is an interesting one. John and I were doing a podcast the other day, and we were talking about agriculture, and I was having a lot of difficulty making John believe me, but John Stepek, our executive editor, when I told him that one third of the food produced around the world is wasted, and that's not just about us throwing old bread in the bin. It's about small farms, and in particular in India, where the infrastructure isn't good enough to get food to market, etc. So this is quite a big deal for all sorts of reasons.
That's absolutely right. You know, the average holding will be less than an acre in India. Mm. So you don't need to sort of work it out. The productivity benefits are huge if you can start to put things together and make it work more effectively. And I think that's a major opportunity for reform, not least because one of the issues Mr. Modi faces in re-election is the fact that, you know, the rural population haven't clearly benefited from his reforms so far, and you know the risk is that they will vote him out of office. So I think if he comes in for another 5 years, this is an area that he'll focus on, and that'll be very beneficial for the economy as a whole.
Interesting. Now, let's say that he doesn't win. And one of the reasons that people always say that, you know, India is one of the greatest of emerging market investments is because it does have this long-standing democracy, rule of law, etc. So it's slightly different place to invest than, I don't know, say China or somewhere in Latin America, etc. So it has a very different feel to it in terms of long-standing democratic and legal institutions. So even if the election doesn't have the result that you expect, you'd still assume a degree of political stability in India, and you'd assume that the reforms that have happened so far wouldn't be reversed. Is that fair?
I think that's absolutely fair. I think the point about India is that, and it's a saying that we've heard many times before, China performs because of the government, India performs despite the government. And, you know, I don't want to be seen to have my cake and eat it, but India's generated something like 12.8% compound dollar return every year for the last 10 years. And if you go back 15 years, it's about 10%. The economy is high frequency. It's growing at kind of around 7.5% to 8%. It's growing off a low base, and it's an enormous economy. And I think, you know, very much consumption driven. So unlike China, that is dependent on a manufacturing base, on an export base, India is very, very much sort of domestically focused, which is interesting because if you think about the way the world is changing in this kind of, you know, the model where you have some mercantilist shift whereby Asian exporters, you know, feed into over indebted, mm-hmm. you know, Western consumers. You know, if that model's broken and the trade wars between China and the US might imply that it could be, you know, where does India sit in that equation? It sits very comfortably as a sort of domestic-facing, you know, large economy with a big population, 50% of whom are under 25, starting to generate some real momentum. So I think, irrespective of who wins in a couple of weeks' time, the economy will still continue to deliver that kind of, you know, 12% compound earnings growth. That's a dollar return, by the way.
Okay, that's interesting. So the suggestion is that India somehow sits outside the globalization of the economy, of the global economy. So, you know, regardless of slowdowns in China or the US or the miseries of the European economy, it can continue to thrive. It's just not as interlinked with the global economy as other markets we might look at.
I think that's right. I mean, the irony of it is that it needs to interlink more and is interlinking more, but it does have these kind of very strong defensive characteristics about it.
And why can I just go back? You say it needs to interlink more. Why? If it's a perfectly well functioning and growing domestic economy, where's the need for global interlinking?
The need for global interlinking is really about job growth, mm-hmm. manufacturing growth. Mm-hmm. I mean, India has a million people entering the working population every month. That's 12 million new jobs that need to be created every year just to stand still.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you look at history,
most Asian economies have done extremely well as a consequence of producing a kind of export-driven model into a developed market consumer. Now, India's lagging on the manufacturing and on the export side of things in a big way. It's 30 to 40 years behind its Asian counterparts, and it needs to catch up. And it offers massive opportunities for Western companies to come in and develop a profitable manufacturing base, not only to sell into the Indian economy, but also to use it as an export hub because of the labour cost arbitrage, because of the rule of law, because of the fact that the majority of the country speaks English. I mean, it's a fantastic place, for foreign direct investment.
Okay, so why has it taken so long? I mean, all those things are true, but they've been true for quite a long time. So why hasn't this happened yet?
Because the country's been run in a what I would describe as a Fabian socialist way for the last 70 years, very inward looking, and almost scared of its own shadow, and desperate to be self-dependent, but not a country that's been outward looking for the last 50, 60 years. And I think, Modi is breaking that mould and trying to lift economic output for everybody, as opposed to a Congress sort of left-leaning socialist government that has been happy to enjoy a kind of cosy cabal between industrialist bureaucrats and politicians at the top end of the curve and let the billion people at the bottom end of the curve kind of continue to
You're making him sound like India's Donald Trump.
It's not a million miles away, Miriam.
Well, that's rather what I'm hearing.
It's not a million miles away, and I think India, is benefiting from a leader who's able to make some tough decisions and bring the country into the 21st century. There's huge potential here. But it needs to catch up, and I think he's rather like someone who's taken over an underperforming chief executive, taken over an underperforming company. He's about turning it around and taking advantage of opportunities that exist to improve productivity and improve efficiency.
Okay. Interesting.
And that's great.
Yeah. Now the other thing that people always say about India is that it is a stock picker's paradise. So many stocks, very active market, lots of stocks that are uncovered or not covered particularly well. So there's endless scope for clever stock pickers like yourself, David, to find things that other people can't. That's also fair, presumably. Or is there now so much investment in India or so many foreign investors in India that it's not necessarily the case anymore?
So I think people talk about India being expensive relative to other emerging market countries, and that puts a lot of investors off. I don't like it. It's too expensive.
Is it?
The headline multiples suggest it trades at a premium to other EM markets, and it does.
What sort of a premium?
On the headline. Well, it varies anywhere between 20 and 80%.
Yeah.
So it is expensive on the headline, but it doesn't necessarily take into account the growth opportunity that India offers. And I think that's vast in comparison to other EM markets. And it is a stock picker's paradise. Over 5,000 listed companies, a huge range of investable sectors. So it's not like Brazil, which is, dare I say it, a bit of a one-trick pony, whether it's iron ore or oil. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's putting it a bit harshly. Russia, perhaps a better example of a one-trick pony. Korea and Taiwan, very tech-focused and perhaps more developed markets than developing markets today. And think about the bench strength of India's sort of entrepreneurial talent. Indians run Microsoft, they run Google, they run Pepsi Cola, they run Amazon. There's a vast range of entrepreneurial talent that if it ever decided to head home, what kind of potential could be utilised.
Now, isn't that happening already? Isn't there a bit of reverse brain drain going on in India? People coming back?
There definitely is. And isn't that exciting?
Yeah.
I mean, if you needed anything to kind of confirm your positive view on India, the fact that we've got these young, US-educated Indian passport holding graduates coming back to their country to take advantage of the opportunity. And it's really technology that's making that change. And it's a point that I wanted to make earlier. I think Mr. Modi is quite, kind of not surprisingly, taking credit for a lot of the change that's happening. But it's technology that's opening up the economy and ensuring that politicians pursue pro-growth policy because they're transparent now.
So when you say technology, what do you mean? You mean the fact that 900 million people have mobile phones?
Yeah. I think that's right, because I think, you know, the smartphone enables the anyone in the smallest village in India, in the largest state in India, to see what's happening in the rest of the world. And, you know, everyone in India, you know, wants an opportunity to improve the lot of their family, and they need an opportunity to do so. And I think Mr. Modi is you know, has realised that, you know, policies have to be pro-growth. You know, people want roads, they want hospitals, they want schools, they want better opportunities to improve their outlook. And, that's what technology is doing. It's also improving process. So it's enabling corruption to be removed because it takes people out of the process. It removes the opportunity for someone to take a bribe.
Yep.
Because if I pay, you know, if the government pays your social security subsidy directly into your bank account, then, you know, what you spend that money on is up to you. But if your subsidy is paid to you in physical format, like a bag of rice or a bottle of cooking fuel or some fertilizer, you know, the opportunity for a bureaucrat or for some middleman to intermediate that to his advantage is very high.
Yeah.
So that's an example of the way technology is improving and removing corruption. And you know, the Prime Minister has done an outstanding job, in my view, of plugging into that. But it's also irreversible change. You can't step back from that. So I think technology is what's ultimately bringing India into a more globalised marketplace. And it's not a question of if foreign companies come to India to take advantage of the opportunities there. It's a question of when they do. Mm. And that's why investors need to have an exposure to the market.
Okay, 5,000 stocks. How on earth do you... How many are there in your portfolio?
35.
Okay, how are you whittling 5,000 down to 35?
So we focus very much on the small and mid-cap area of the market. So the portfolio's median market cap is around about $1 billion. Mm-hmm. We see much more opportunity at the lower end of the market. You talked about the way, is India already overcovered, or, you know, are there too many foreign investors there? Not at all. It's massively underinvested. On a purchasing power parity basis, it's the third largest economy in the world. As a proportion of MSCI Global Index, less than 1%. So it's, you know, but, you know, you go down to the lower end of the market, and here you can find companies which are growing at 15 to 20%. That's bottom line earnings year in, year out. You know, so consistent, transparent, hopefully predictable earnings streams compounding, you know, at that level is very attractive. Run by, you know, second or third generation entrepreneurs who, you know, may or may not have been Western educated, who are starting to understand the way, you know, corporate governance issues help to improve the multiple on which their company trades. Mm-hmm. And if you can plug into that, then, you know, you don't need to make too many changes to your portfolio. It'll just continue to compound over time. So we whittle it down by going straight to small and mid-cap. Then we do very kind of intrinsic quality screens on, you know, we're looking for companies with good quality balance sheets, with positive cash flow, managed by people who, you know, we have strong conviction in terms of their levels of integrity and their ability to deliver kind of returns to shareholders over the cost of capital. And so we do a lot of due diligence on our companies. I would say out of the 5,000 that you mentioned, our addressable group is probably no more than 400. And from that 400, we whittle it down to, you know, to 35. Mm-hmm. And the holding periods in the portfolio, you know, can be anywhere between, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. So having found a company that we like, that's run by people that we trust, in an area of the market where we see structural growth opportunity, we don't need to invest in the market leader. We need to invest in an area of the market where, in a part of the sector where we can just see consistent, transparent growth. And we're happy to pay an expensive multiple for it, because good companies don't come cheap.
Well, sometimes they do.
Sometimes they do, but quite often cheap is cheap for a reason. And you know, there's a lot of corruption in India. There's a lot of inefficiencies in the market. There's a lot of value traps out there. So, you know, and if you're paying, you know, upwards of 20 times earnings, but your earnings growth is consistently, you know, 15 to 20%, it's not cheap looking forward 2-3 years. It's actually really good value. So I think India is about, you know, you have to have the mindset to stomach the inevitable volatility that comes in the market. That's currency depreciation, that's, you know, huge swings, you know, periods of underperformance, periods of outperformance. But over time, you get this sort of consistent 12% compound growth, which, you know, relative to other EMs and relative to other developed markets and other asset classes, pretty attractive.
Pretty attractive. Okay, I tell you what. Tell us all about your favourite stock. Everyone has a favourite stock. People are always telling me they don't have favourite stocks, like they don't have favourite children. It's never true. All fund managers have a favourite stock. What's yours?
So we've owned a company called Jyoti Laboratories. We've had it in the portfolio for about 5 or 6 years. It's a funny company because it sounds like some kind of pharmaceutical company. In fact, it's fast moving consumer goods. It's household goods, so it produces washing up liquids, dishwash powders. It produces mosquito repellent, but it's premium. The product that it sells most of, and is a whitening agent that you put in your wash. And it whitens your shirts. So if you're a middle-ranking executive that goes to work, you use this brand called Ujala in your washing, and it helps to make your shirt look fresh and clean.
Well, surely it's like clean already if you just washed it.
Yeah, but you know, this shirt may last another 2-3 years if you use Ujala. And Indians are very price conscious, and they also want to look smart. You know, Ujala has an 80% market share. And what Jyoti have been brilliant at doing is then, you know, they've got the brand identity of Ujala. It's got huge brand, you know, acceptance in the market. You know, 300 to 400 middle class Indians use Ujala in order to preserve the time that their shirt will last. It'll last a couple of years longer. And they're now selling many more products into that sort of existing brand identity. So, you know, washing powder, washing up liquid, very simple, very straightforward goods, which, you know, as households, you know, start to, as household income starts to grow, these are very straightforward products. So it's consistent, transparent, it's predictable.
But you've been holding it for 5 or 6 years already. You're still happy with it valuation-wise, etc.?
Yeah, we are, because what we like about it is that it's consistent. We know we're going to get 15 to 20% earnings growth out of it. And we still see that from a distribution perspective, there's a lot further it can go. And what I like about it also is that, you know, a lot of people like investing in the multinational brands in India, you know, the Hindustan Unilevers or the Procter & Gambles. Jyoti Laboratories competes with these guys, but it competes in brands like Ujala, where Unilever and Procter & Gamble are never going to go.
And is it cheaper than them?
It's not, actually. It's around about the same multiple. But I think it's got better potential over the long term, because it's got a far bigger distribution reach than those guys.
Okay, interesting. Right, now we're coming up on 25 minutes, which I think is about the tolerance limit for our listeners. So one last thing. There are several Indian investment trusts or India-focused investment trusts available in the UK. Why yours, not them?
I think because we are genuinely active managers. But because we're relatively smaller, the portfolio is 150 million sterling, roughly speaking, give or take. We have much more flexibility to invest in the areas of the market where we see real value and real growth. If you invest in a larger investment trust, which is a, you know, the other major competitors in the market are, you know, anywhere between $500 and $1 billion, you're going to be investing in the top 50 stocks in India, because that's where the liquidity is that allows those large investment trusts to get size. And, you know, that's much more quasi-index tracking.
Yeah.
You know, we're concentrated, we're active, you know, we've got people on the ground, and we're much more flexible at the bottom end of the market, I would say. So, you know, buying into the real domestic growth story, the Jyoti Laboratories, rather than the big mega caps that have already done their stuff.
Okay, Dave, that's brilliant. Thank you so much. That was David Cornell, manager of the Indian Capital Growth Fund, which you can find on, any platform, right? Thank you so much. Yeah. I will talk to you again, I hope.
Not at all. Thanks, Marin.